This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Heatwave blues can't escape the heat. Dancing in the sun on burning concrete. Heatwave blues, no relief in sight. Dangerous days and sweltering nights.
Over 900 worshippers died of heat when it went over 50 degrees C, 122 Fahrenheit, in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, during the Hajj. During weeks of long extreme heat domes over India, Mexico, North Africa, and the Middle East, nobody counted the dead. Only Europeans and North Americans matter to big media. Around the world, people died silently in record extreme heat, unreported. In this show, after an extreme weather update, we revisit urban heat survival tips with Professor Matt Santamouris. Then Dr. Anders Leverman from Potsdam University reminds us, more people are displaced by river floods than any other extreme event.
Look up to the sky, hope for a breeze, wish for a cloud, bring in some ease. Turn on the news, hear the weatherman, says more heat to come, hold on if you can.
By some estimates, at least 900 people died of the heat during the religious Hajj in Saudi Arabia. The final total may be higher. Hundreds of bodies filled the morgue in Mecca. The heat reached 51.8 degrees C, 125 Fahrenheit, setting a new record for Mecca. By tradition and religious duty, millions of men and a few women walked through open avenues to various sites of outdoor worship in the relentless sun. Dead bodies were filmed on the streets of Mecca. The Saudi authorities did try. They set up a registration system and built air-conditioned tents for those registered. They tried to clear away about 100,000 worshippers, they say, who were not registered, but countless more showed up. Some avenues had giant spray nozzles overhead. They tried, and they died in the holy place. At some point, adaptation is not possible. The only real solution? Reduce oil production by about 20% a year and end production by 2030. Humanity, of course, is doing the opposite. According to the Energy Institute, the world burned more oil, gas, and coal than ever before. Let that sink in. Fossil fuel burning increased 2.1% over the previous year, which was already a record high. One tally says 40 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide were added to the atmosphere. The real tally, including methane, nitrous oxide, and other warming gases, was much higher. In 2023, humans broke another barrier, burning more than 100 million barrels a day of oil alone. 100 million barrels a day. The United States increased production by 8%. Clean energy, like solar and wind, are being added at faster rates, but those gains are just being added to the fossil energy pile as demand grows, especially in developing nations. Despite installing more than half of all the new alternative energy last year, fossil fuel burning by China rose 6%. India consumed 8% more fossil fuels and used more coal than North America and Europe combined. In Greece, as you know, tourists went out and died in more record-smashing heat. A friend in Greece writes saying, despite growing up with heat, now for the first time, he fears summer. At one point, the fire chief in Attica said new fires broke out almost every 10 minutes. In Athens, Greece shut its primary tourist attraction, the Acropolis, as well as schools, for 43 degrees C heat, 109 degrees Fahrenheit. That isn't the feels-like index. That's the temperature. Heat records were broken across the Middle East and China. In Iraq, Iran, and Afghanistan, it is too hot to work. But many must, or families will go hungry. As meteorologist Scott Duncan reports, brutal heat, New Delhi, India, just recorded its hottest night on record at the observatory since 1901. The heat wave has been rewriting many records. New Delhi has hit 40 degrees C or greater for 37 consecutive days now, end quote from Scott Duncan. Temperature guru Herrera posted on his Twitter site on June the 19th, quote, currently 156 countries are breaking heat records these hours. This is 250% more than any full month before mid-2023. June 2024 is breaking about double of the station records than May 2024, the most record-breaking month in history. This is one of a kind, end quote. It has been deadly hot in Mexico for weeks, an absolute record heat over the Caribbean islands. But now heat finally arrives in North America, now it gets reported. 98 degrees Fahrenheit in Boston, whoo-hoo-hoo. They're not ready for that. The first-named tropical storm of the season slammed into Mexico, but the U.S. media only reports flooding in Texas. Silence about their neighbors and major trade partners during the damaging storm. A soggy low with floods and erosion is predicted in a three-week extreme rain event over Central America. With an early heat dome like this, there may be more deaths in the U.S. Northeast and particularly New England because, well, fewer people have air conditioning. Cities there are less prepared for extreme heat. And the first blast of heat every year is often the most deadly. People are caught off guard. In areas where heat is uncommon, people have a lower tolerance as well. For example, as we hear from Matt Santamouris in a coming segment, with temperatures over 90 degrees, 32 degrees C, they're common in Greece, but in England, when the heat gets up to just 85 Fahrenheit or 29 C, people start showing up in emergency rooms with heat effects. Extreme heat continues in Africa, far beyond the seasonal norms anyone expects. More records in the Sahel, including in Sudan, where about 5 million people are huddled in makeshift tent home camps as almost permanent refugees. They are hungry and inordinately hot. It does not cool down below body temperature at night. It's not reported. Nobody cares. Personally, I feel guilt and shame that we are causing this suffering for simple people so far away. They got few or no benefits at all from the fossil burning boom. Meanwhile, here's a Canadian news item. Canadians plan more destination weddings. Yeah, let's fly 50 people to Fiji. We'll do it for fun and for love and for memories, and we will ruin the future for our kids. We make other people suffer for our pointless travels, wasted energy, and frenetic driving of gas-guzzling cars. We are fossil sadists. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. The way downtown cities are built, extreme heat may drive you out. It's pretty close to that right now in Darwin, Australia, where temperatures up to 70 degrees C, an astounding 158 degrees Fahrenheit, have been measured in certain places in the central business district. It doesn't have to be that way. We can go a long way towards adapting urban heat islands into something much more livable. Our next guest is an expert in that. Professor Matt Santamouris is currently Professor of High Performance Architecture in the University of New South Wales in Australia, but he's a global guy as a Professor of Energy Physics at the University of Athens and visiting professor at times at universities in London, Tokyo, Italy, and Singapore. Matt is editor-in-chief of the journal Energy and Buildings. He's the author and editor of 14 books on heat islands, solar energy, and energy conservation in buildings. Good stuff. He's published over 180 peer-reviewed papers. Matt Santamouris, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for your invitation.
Well, this is a good time to be talking about heat where you are. What was the weather like in Australia?
We had a very serious heat wave last, January and February, where in Western Sydney we had temperatures close to 45 degrees for more than a week.
Well, I interview a lot of scientists about the rise in global mean temperatures, but you're looking at the extremes hitting urban areas right now. Why is it important to look at very local temperatures as well?
Because, you know, local temperature affect the quality of life, you know, of people. Once you have very high temperatures, you have a tremendous impact on energy. You have a tremendous impact on morbidity, on mortality, on comfort, on health, on peak electricity demand, on cooling demand, on everything. So peak demand and peak temperature really define the quality of life. Average temperature, it doesn't really show something because you may have a low temperature during the night, you may have a very high temperature during the day. So what? You know, it's very important to understand really how is the temperature during the daytime and how is the temperature during the nighttime and which are the characteristics of the variation of the temperature during the day.
Now, the city of Darwin is on the north coast of Australia. It's expected to be hot. It is tropical. But have there been some recent studies done about what is happening in their downtown area, or as they would call it, the central business district?
Yes, we have monitored the whole area, and we have, let's say, collected a lot of data about the ambient temperature and the surface temperature in the CBD area of Darwin. And we have then developed some monitoring, some mitigation technologies and mitigation scenarios in order to decrease the temperature. And actually, we try to implement all these new technologies downtown Darwin. The surface temperature, as you mentioned before, was very high because of the use of non-appropriate materials, for example, bitumen parking loads and many other things that presented, let's say, surface temperatures up to 70 degrees Celsius, while the ambient temperature was about, let's say, 3 to 4 degrees higher than in the surrounding area. So the intensity of the urban heat island in Darwin was about 3 to 4 degrees, and this had a tremendous impact on energy, on mortality, on morbidity, on comfort, on everything.
Yes, people die earlier because of extreme heat. We've been doing a series on that on Radio EcoShock. Now, in April 2017, you co-authored a paper titled Mortality Associated with High Ambient Temperatures, Heat Waves, and the Urban Heat Island in Athens, Greece. Please tell us what you found there.
It is well known that, you know, mortality, heat-related mortality, is very much associated with, let's say, the peak temperature. And in many places in the world, we have found that it follows a U-shaped curve. And the higher the temperature, the higher, let's say, the mortality. There is a threshold temperature over which mortality is increasing almost exponentially. And this threshold temperature is not the same for every place. For example, for Athens, it is close to 32.5 degrees because people there is adapted to high temperatures. But in London, it's close to 23 degrees. So in every place, there is a threshold temperature over which heat-related mortality is increasing really exponentially or very highly. So what we found in Athens was that once the temperature exceeds, let's say, the threshold, 32 degrees, mortality is increasing really very rapidly. And this is a major problem because it affects the vulnerable population, it affects the aged people, it affects, let's say, children, it affects those that they are living in non-proper houses, low-income people. And this is, let's say, a social penalty imposed, you know, to those that they cannot really afford to have air conditioning the whole day at home.
Well, it's partly cultural then, and whether people are already adapted or expecting heat, but there's also the factor of the humidity in the weather. Isn't that important as far as mortality goes?
It is. It is very important. Humidity is very important. It plays a very important role. Humidity in Athens is not so high, so humidity is not the major problem in Athens. But in other places, for example, in Darwin, humidity is a major problem. So the combination of humidity with, let's say, the ambient temperature can be, let's say, very, very important and may define the levels of heat-related mortality. But, let's say, all the studies that we have from all the, let's say, the last heat waves around the world has also shown that outdoor pollution and indoor pollution, but mainly outdoor pollution, in combination with high temperature and humidity, may, let's say, create a very fatal cocktail, you know, for the human beings.
On November 27th at news.com in Australia, they published some very revealing heat photos. I like them. There was a rooftop parking lot that was off the charts hot. while a nearby lot with a large tree was a lot cooler. How can planting help cool off our cities, Matt?
Greenery makes a lot because greenery, you know, offers evapotranspiration and decreases the temperature in our cities. And at the same time, you know, because of shading and many other functions of greenery, may help a lot to decrease temperatures and mitigate urban heat island and improve comfort conditions. Greenery is one of the best mitigation technologies we may apply. Also, we have to understand that greenery is very effective after a certain temperature. Above the threshold, greenery is not producing any more evapotranspiration because it has to be protected. It has to protect the water, you know, of the tree. And in this case, you know, greenery is not really responding to the mitigation. So greenery is a very effective and very, let's say, important mitigation technologies that may help up to a certain, let's say, temperature. Above this temperature, greenery cannot help a lot. And this is the reason that in many parks during heat waves, temperature is higher than outside the parks.
And there's been a lot of talk of painting roofs white to reflect more of the sun's energy. You published an article in September 2017 on reflective geoengineering technologies in cities. Matt Santamouris, please tell us about that.
Yeah, we have developed some reflective technologies for pavements and roofs. Reflective technologies that really help to decrease the surface temperature of the pavements and decrease the ambient temperature. We have more than 200, applications all around the world, and we have seen that the use of reflective pavements of high technology may reduce, the surface temperature up to 15 degrees and at the same time decrease the ambient temperature up to 2.5 degrees. This is very important because it may decrease the cooling load of buildings up to 60-70%, decrease the heat-related mortality by about 60-70% as well, and also decrease the peak electricity demand by 5-6% in the city, and also improve the comfort levels. This is a very mature technology. Actually, we're working with development of more efficient, pavement technologies using some very advanced materials, and we hope that in the next 5 years we will be able to decrease the ambient temperature up to 4 or 5 degrees.
Wait a minute. If we just change the way we build things and the way we pave things, we could reduce mortality by about 60% and save about 60% on the energy use of buildings?
Energy use for cooling and the heat-related mortality, not mortality in general.
Right. Well, that's still an amazing amount. We should get going on that.
Of course. So the recent study we have performed for Western Sydney, it shows that in the northwestern part of the city, where temperature is to about 9 degrees higher than in the eastern part of the city, the application of advanced mitigation technologies may reduce the peak temperature up to 2.5 degrees, but at the same time decrease, the heat-related mortality by about 90%. Just to understand that in the eastern part of the city, heat-related mortality is close to 7, deaths per 100,000 inhabitants. In the western part of the city, maybe close to 14. Application of, advanced mitigation technologies may reduce heat-related mortality down to 7, which is, a decrease close to 90%. So it is really very important. And in my opinion, the main problem and the main issue we will face in the future is really health and not so much energy. Energy is important, but we know how really to face the energy problems. Health is going to be the major issue in the next years.
Well, of course, the real solution is, as you say, to slash our greenhouse gas emissions. And I see you're involved in a project called Zero Plus. The longer title sounds really exciting, Achieving Near Zero and Positive Energy Settlements in Europe Using Advanced Energy Technology. How do you envision these Zero Plus settlements in Europe?
This is a very prestigious project. This is the flagship of the European Union, and I'm very happy to be the coordinator of this project. This project aims to design and also, build 4 zero energy settlements, one in Cyprus, one in Italy, one in France, and one in the UK. Actually, we have, finalized the design, and 2 out of the 4 settlements are under construction, and we expect that by the beginning of the next year, the construction will start in the other, sites. And by, 2019, all the settlements will be ready. This is a major, let's say, issue because actually we know a lot about, let's say, zero-energy buildings, and we have optimized zero-energy buildings. But we have found that zero-energy buildings increase a bit of the cost, you know, of the residential or the office buildings in general. So the best way, really, to integrate renewables and energy conservation technologies in the building sector is to have, let's say, a community-integrated renewable and energy efficiency technologies than building-integrated technologies. Once the renewable technologies and the energy efficiency technologies are integrated at the community level, the cost is much lower, the management is much better, and the performance is also, let's say, much better. So this is a win-win situation. This is what we have designed, and this is what we implement, actually, in the four, let's say, settlements. And we expect to have all the monitoring results, the first monitoring results, by the end of the next year.
Matt, could you tell us where one of these zero settlements are so we can look them up on the Internet?
Yeah, there's a site, Zero Energy Zero Plus Program. You may, let's say, Google Zero Plus, and you will find the site. And all information is there.
Okay. You know, you just reminded me that back, I think it was in 2010, I broadcast a workshop by the Austrian zero emissions architect Guido Wimmers, and he's designed countless net zero buildings in Europe, from apartment buildings to schools and municipal offices, and some of them never even had to turn on a furnace or an air conditioner, even in Austria. It makes me wonder why we don't mandate net zero buildings for new construction, say in Australia, in the United States, in Canada, where we need them.
In Europe, it is mandatory. Since 2018, all the public buildings, since 2020, all new private buildings have to be zero energy or almost zero energy buildings. So it is mandatory in Europe. In Australia, I think that the quality of the building, let's say construction, is not the best possible, and a lot of things have to happen. Perhaps of the climate, perhaps for many other reasons, energy protection and the energy consumption of buildings has not taken really the proper attention. I think that there is a huge potential for improvement, and this is something that has to happen here. In Canada, I think that actually the level of knowledge about zero-energy buildings is very high. I know that there is a wonderful work that is happening actually in the University of Concordia in Montreal. I know that there are many, many zero-energy buildings. I think that this is not a technical problem. The knowledge is there. It is more, let's say, a commercial problem. It is more a policy problem if, the governments would like really to invest in it and push, the country towards such a direction.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign-up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm talking with Professor Matt Santamouris from the University of New South Wales in Sydney. And extreme city heat is getting pretty important. It's uncomfortable for people in those urban heat sinks. It can be deadly. I'm wondering, Matt, can we just keep air conditioning everything so we arrive by an air-conditioned car, we get out into air-conditioned buildings? We're making these technical cool bubbles to stay alive as long as the power stays on, but there must be limits to how much we can do.
There are some limits, for sure. Depends, on the magnitude of the problem. Once, the ambient temperature is, very close to the temperature of the human body, yes, we have many alternatives, and we may, avoid the use of air conditioning, and we may apply some passive cooling techniques, and we may reduce substantially the use of air conditioning. Once the ambient temperature, indoor or outdoor, is close to the body temperature, we may apply several passive cooling techniques, and we may, avoid the use of air conditioning. Actually, we have designed buildings with almost a zero energy consumption for cooling, or very, very low energy consumption for cooling. So, yes, it is possible. But on the other hand, once temperature exceeds a certain threshold, for example, during heat waves, you may have 45 degrees, 46 degrees, adaptation is very difficult. And although the quality of the building may reduce the cooling needs, up to 60, 70, 80%, depends on the quality of the building, human beings cannot really afford to live under these conditions for a long period. So air conditioning is absolutely necessary. In this case, we need some technical adaptation measures to protect the population, and especially the vulnerable population. We don't have alternatives, you know, for such a range of temperatures. We can really avoid the use of air conditioning up to 35, 34, 35 degrees, and it's not so simple, but we can do that. But once the temperature is much higher than the temperature of the human body, then we don't have enough of alternatives really to protect human beings.
Matt, the latest paper you co-authored is called Aerial Survey and In-Situ Measurements of Materials and Vegetation in the Urban Fabric. I'm wondering, how do you do this? What tools do you use to really find out what the heat is in cities?
We're using drones. We have designed and developed some drones that they may, let's say, record information in the visible, say, spectrum about the surface temperature and the ambient temperature in the cities. Both in Athens and in Sydney, we're using some sophisticated drones, and these drones are following some energy buses which are equipped with some antennas going up to 20 meters, where all the possible instruments have been placed, so we can measure all the, let's say, characteristics of the ambient temperature, and at the same time with the drone, the characteristics of the surface temperature, and so have a very good knowledge of what is happening, you know, in the urban environment. Monitoring and diagnostic tools are extremely important if we like really to offer solutions for our cities. If we don't do that, unfortunately, we don't have the proper information and we risk it to solve the wrong problem. We may apply, let's say, technologies that are not really the better technologies or the best technologies to solve the problem. So it is very, very important to understand the nature of the problem, the characteristics of the problem through proper diagnostic techniques, and then design and apply the proper mitigation technologies.
Are cities starting to apply these adaptation techniques? Where are we now in this process?
Depends on the city. In Europe, actually, there are some adaptation measures and some emergency measures trying really to offer the proper, let's say, adaptation policies to people that cannot really afford to have an air conditioner at home or their vulnerable population, etc. So they open some, let's say, sport facilities, air conditioning sport facilities. They offer air conditioning transport, many, many things. And this really may save lives. But the more important is not there. The most important, in my opinion, is really to have a global policy to improve the quality of the built environment. It is extremely important to improve the quality of our cities, improve the quality of our, let's say, buildings. So it is very, very significant, you know, first of all, to avoid the overheating of our cities and to use the proper materials, use greenery, use water, use some sophisticated mitigation technologies. We are able to decrease the peak temperature of our cities up to 3 degrees. In the next years, we'll be able to decrease temperature up to 4 or 5 degrees. These technologies have to be implemented. We have already many, many examples, more than 200 implementations all around the world, very successful. At the same time, we have all the technology, all the knowledge to improve the quality of our buildings, decrease the energy consumption, provide comfort, have a better air quality. So this is, in my opinion, one of the highest priority. And it is not just a priority that will, let's say, improve the quality of living, which is of life, which is very important. But on the other hand, will create huge opportunities for employment, huge opportunities, you know, for further developments, will be a new, let's say, financial opportunity for the whole world. So retrofitting of our cities, retrofitting of our buildings, in my opinion, is one of the major, let's say, opportunities, and is a win-win, let's say, situation.
We have been talking with Professor Mateos Santamouris. He teaches at several universities, including Athens right now. He's with the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. And I'll put links to some of Matt's papers and his bio and the new science we've talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Matt, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
My town is on fire. Hit the accelerator. What's this rate? Hit the accelerator. The place is underwater.
but you say hit the accelerator.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Bring the oil and give me some gas. Speed it all up. Hit the accelerator. Accelerator.
River floods already displace more people within countries than any other cause, and they affect far more people than other disasters. New science reveals humans will have to prepare and adapt much harder for even more river flooding in the next 20 years due to climate change. Our guest is a scientist with many roles. Dr. Anders Leverman is professor of dynamics at the climate system at Potsdam University in Germany. He is a leader at the renowned Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, or PIC. He's an adjunct scientist at Columbia University in New York and lead author of the latest IPCC chapter on sea level change. He's a journal editor and more. Dr. Leverman is co-author of a new paper, Adaptation Required to Preserve Future High-End River Flood Risk at Present Levels, as published in Science Advances January 10th, 2018. Anders Leverman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I know you're busy, so let's get right to the new paper you co-authored. Why pour so much work into studying river flooding?
Well, river flooding is actually one of the most devastating causes for damages that are caused meteorologically on the planet. And actually, meteorological damages are the strongest damages. If you ask the Munich Re, an insurance company who has the longest record for insured damages on the planet, as far as I know. So meteorological damages are important. They will most likely become more intense under global warming.
Have extreme rainfall events and floods already increased since the 1970s?
It's quite difficult if you ask for the statistics. We have been, and a lot of people still do this, which I think is important and very valid. But if we actually wait for the statistics to be done, so that we can make a scientific statement that extreme events have increased in intensity or in frequency, it's generally already too late to a certain extent. I know that this is not a very popular way to put it, because a lot of people work on the statistics of weather extremes, and they should continue to do so. But society needs answers before they have already experienced this intensification. And that's why I very much appreciate that more and more people and more research is actually now focusing on the physical mechanisms of weather extremes. You know, that has been done for a long time, but it's done more and more. And we start to slowly understand why things become more intense. And that's why I'm giving not a very straight answer here. I realize this. But my point is that I don't really care whether they have intensified or not, because I know they will most likely become more intense under warming. And that is for very simple physical reasons. First of all, warmer temperatures, we have more evaporation on the planet. And the water that we put into the atmosphere has to get out again. There is water, obviously, in the atmosphere, and there better be. But there isn't a lot of water that the atmosphere can hold. So everything that evaporates has to fall down again. So we'll have more rainfall under global warming. In addition to that, we have a warmer water. And that's, again, Claudius Clapeyron equation, a very simple physics. A warmer atmosphere can hold more water vapor and thereby can transport more water. And you know what we find, and that is actually statistics, and that's actually what we can understand. We find that extreme rainfall events increase with the saturation value of how much water you'd actually have in the atmosphere. And that's why we have two good reasons why intense rainfall events and thereby flooding will intensify under global warming. And we've seen a degree of warming. So there has been an intensification that is not so easily found statistically, but physically it should have been.
Well, I'm certainly seeing it in the news. I know from reporting 10, 20 years ago that there just weren't that many extreme records for precipitation, whether it's rain or snow, being set, as I've had to report more recently, but that's just an experience. It's not an official scientific statistic. Before we go deeper into this, are we just talking about river flooding for people in faraway countries, or will industrialized nations in America and Europe also have to make adjustments and changes for this?
Well, we have an identification of the hydrological cycle. And what's very important in our study was that we focused only on the next 25 to 30 years. And the reason for that, generally, you know, climate scientists, and that's me included, are looking for this century, to the end of the century, because the climate change is a long-term problem. And this is where, you know, this is the century in which we have to mitigate the climate change and really change our energy system globally. But in this study, we used the fact that the next 25 to 30 years of global warming have already been caused by the emissions of the last decades up to a century. And that's a very dangerous statement to make for, you know, if you don't listen carefully, because it does not mean that it doesn't matter what we do in the next 25 or 30 years, because what we do in the next 25 or 30 years will determine what is happening after 2040. And, you know, once 2040 arrives, we can't do anything about it anymore. We have to act now. So this was, again, a long answer, but what I'm saying is in our study, we looked at the next 25 to 30 years, and that's why we can make an actual prediction about the intensification of river floods. And what we found is that river floods increase around the planet. But if you look at the adaptation, so also in the U.S. and also in Europe, but if you look at the need for adaptation, something interesting happens. The need of adaptation, and we defined it in such a way that we said, what do you have to do in order for the risk of floods in the next 25 years to be the same as the risk of floods that you had in the last 25 years. And what comes into play here is that different countries have different risk aversion. So in Europe, we are better protected against floods than in India or Indonesia. In the U.S., you have actually among the best protection, and you are used to this kind of protection. Now, if you want to keep this protection in the U.S., you have to do as much as we have to do in Germany in order to keep our level, and as much as people in India and Indonesia have to do to keep their level of protection. So that takes into account that different societies have set their protection level, their need or their desire for security at different levels. And since the U.S. has a very high level, you know, if you want to keep it, you have to work for it.
Now, this paper is free in full text online, and there's some great graphics with it. And in those graphics, it shows that there are new areas where people will experience floods in the 2030s that did not experience them in that period from 1971 to 2004. Where are some of those new flood areas?
Well, that is actually in a lot of regions in the United States. Since the flood here is defined as exceeding the flood protection level, you know, most of the regions in the U.S. are protected against floods. But overall, if you would do nothing, if you would not increase further protection because, for example, your administration doesn't take climate change seriously, then the U.S. overall increases the number of affected people by a factor of 9. So there will be nine times more people affected by floods in the next 25 years than there were in the last 25 years. These numbers are lower for China. You know, it's only about a doubling there. And they're tremendously high for the United Kingdom, with a factor of almost 30. And Indonesia, India, and also Germany is quite high. So we really have to do something in order to stay protected.
Yes, the interesting thing in the United States is that some of the areas where projected flooding is really going to increase look to be in the Ohio River valleys, the Mississippi River valleys, in states that actually voted for President Trump, who doesn't believe in climate change. One interesting sidelight I noticed, though, that in California, there's been a lot of discussion about whether a mega flood could happen there, as happened in the 1800s. And there seemed to be some disagreement amongst the climate models about the impacts of this in California. Could you talk to us about that?
Yeah, if you have a look at our study, it was close to call. That's what you would call it. The uncertainty in California and in large parts of the west of the United States was so big that we were not able to make a definite statement, and that shows you that there is a lot of uncertainty here. What is kind of an important lesson from our study, but from others, of course, it's not a special study in this, is that you can protect against climate change to a certain extent. You know, sea level rise can be protected against by dikes, by coastal protection. All kinds of methods are available. But if you don't protect yourself, then the impacts are really devastating. You know, that's why we get these large numbers. That's why we get, an eightfold or ninefold increase in the number of affected people. If you don't do anything, if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. For example, with sea level, it's a different problem, but it's also a flooding problem. If your dike is simply too low for the sea level that you have, for the ocean height, world's ocean height, then you get tremendously, a large number of extra effects, extra impacts. And the number of affected people increases dramatically. And this is the same here with river floods. We were actually, in our study, not able to make a lot of statements about the Western U.S.
It's very distressing to see that the equatorial area of Africa will face even greater river flooding, because places like the Congo are already poor and poorly governed, if not at war. What changes are coming for that region, or for Africa, let's say, in the coming climate deluges?
Africa is complicated, with respect to rain. We found, for example, that there was in a different study, but we found in 7 of the 21 climate models that did these simulations for the UN climate report, in 7 of these models, a monsoon system actually developed in the southern Sahel zone, which is at the moment a desert or close to a desert, so there's very, very little rain. And if you look at the countries, these include countries like Mali, which have civil wars at the moment, which are in unrest, and it's a terrible situation in a lot of these countries. And you would think that monsoon rainfall, that is a regular seasonal rainfall, would be a good thing for the region, and I'm actually sure it would. But having said that, and any changes that are sudden pose a problem, at least in the beginning. That is something that you can't, I'm not saying from a climate science perspective, but, having thought that, working on societal problems too, if you think of it, if you have a sudden change in the climate, that is generally a problem, because it is inducing changes in society. We'll see a lot of fluctuations in Africa, and studies have found that whenever there are climate fluctuations, you have a higher chance of societal response or unrest.
And about one-third of Pakistan went underwater in 2010 due to river flooding. What happens in Asia in the 2030s, according to your new science?
Well, Pakistan was flooded in 2010 and again in 2011. This was a special event. These were two special events which were caused by what, in the U.S. is they often called polar vortex. It was caused by a meandering of the jet stream, which led to a blockage situation, which led to a 4 to 6 weeks long hot period over Russia, including Moscow, and a lot of peatland burning there or smoldering. And at the same time, a low-pressure system in Pakistan, which created the largest freshwater lake on the planet, you know, and was a disaster. And the next year, it happened again. These kind of events are, if anything, underestimated in our climate model. Because our climate models, they are made, you know, they're averaging out the weather in general. That's not, you know, they're not weather prediction models. So we tend to underestimate these extreme events. And we've tried to correct for this a little bit in our study, but there is, you know, a general conviction that the problem will be worse than is predicted by the climate models. And this is also the feeling, as you, I mentioned earlier, the feeling that a lot of people have. So if we already have a problem, if we see a problem in our models, then there probably is a problem. Specifically for Asia, we have the strongest signal in India, which is close to Pakistan, has more people, and Indonesia, which sees a 26-fold increase in affected people if nothing is done. And for these poor people, for these poor countries, it is actually a challenge to protect their population.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Professor Anders Levermann from Potsdam, Germany. We're talking about humans, how they all over the world will have to prepare for coming floods as the climate shifts. I found this paper very conservative in its underlying assumptions, and probably for science that's the way it has to be. I mean, one of the issues is the assumptions based on population that it would be static, and yet we know we're adding another 83 million more humans a year. Why would you choose a static population model for this study?
Yes, that's a very important thing. So the number of affected people will increase beyond the numbers that we put in the model because, as you said, the number of people overall is increasing. We, for the main statement of the paper, which was how much do we have to increase the protection in order to stay at the same risk level in the future as we had it in the past, we only used the relative number of affected people. And so that would have only been changed by a change in the density structure, in the relative density structure of the population. And since we don't have very good means to predict this at the moment, you know, people who work on this, and I trust in this research, but still, we thought that we stay, to a certain extent, we stay on the natural side of this problem and just say, well, if people don't move away, if they stay where they are, which is a reasonable assumption for the next 25 years, then this is the outcome that you'll have to protect in this way. And another reason is, by the way, that the planning for the protection, for the adaptation is done now. So a lot of municipalities will work with the data they have now.
Well, that does make sense, but people are moving. I mean, about 3 million people a week are moving into cities out of rural areas. There is a mass migration underway. Your study does look at a number of big cities that will be strongly affected by river flooding in the next couple of decades. Another question here, the expected increase in extreme precipitation events, does that figure into this study? I mean, you talk about a 1 in 100-year flood. But what if that becomes 1 in 30 years or even once every decade? Is it able to account for those kinds of possibilities?
So many interviews on this, and this is something that no one asked. I think that is perfect. You're a really good interviewer. Yes, well, this is actually at the core of the study. Yes, it does. That's what actually, you know, we use a climate model, which we then feed into what we call bias correct for weather extremes so that it can reproduce the past weather extremes properly so that we hope that we can have some hope that it will we produce a future weather extremes properly, and then we feed this into our river routing schemes and discharge models, which have a very high resolution. Then we look, you know, at even a higher resolution at the flooded areas and compare this to the density of the population. So at the core, there's actually the climate model, which is accounting for these increases in the, well, to a certain extent, to the increase in frequency and intensity of floods.
Now, Anders Leverman, you led the reporting by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change on sea level rise. Does this study on river flooding include the growing damages from storm surges running up those rivers?
No, it doesn't. It's really separate, and there's a lot to be done there. We actually have to learn a lot about coastal flooding, too. A lot of people work on this. There's intense and important work done there, and we are not quite finished on how the sea level will actually rise. We think we can make good statements about the next few decades, but sea level rise is a long-term problem. It's something that we cause now and will go on for hundreds of years. You know, as we now remember, or some of us remember the Roman Empire, as you know, the Romans that gave us the aqueducts and certain, and the Greeks that gave us democracy. In the same way, we will be remembered in 2,000 years as the guys who started the sea level rise, which is still continuing. So sea level is a long-term problem, and we have not figured out yet how fast it will unfold, especially beyond the next few decades. So I think for 20, 30 years, we can make a statement, but beyond that, it's difficult. And to actually compute what will be flooded and what has to, you know, where protection is necessary is a very difficult problem. I know that people around the U.S. work on this, especially you know, in San Francisco. I'm very impressed by the work of the local authorities. But yeah, it's not included here, and it'll worsen the problem.
And your study looks at what adaptation will be needed to survive in the first half of this century. But if we can't implement the emissions controls, say, by the Paris Accord, is it possible that river floods will just become totally unmanageable in the second half of this century?
Well, you can always leave behind your houses and your regions, you know. But if you think about it, you know, that also is true for sea level rise. If we continue to emit carbon as we have done so in the past, and we continue beyond now, and we don't keep the Paris Climate Accord, then the United States will lose about 10% of its land mass eventually to sea level rise. Now, assume that another country would come and say, we take 10% of your land away. I don't think the U.S. would take this lightly, would they? And that's not the U.S. only, and no country on the planet would take it lightly to, if you know, if someone takes away their land. But here, we emit carbon, and we expand the oceans by the warming atmosphere, and we melt the ice on the planet. And we just, by that, give up land, our land, to the sea. Some countries would actually be affected in an existential way, in the sense that they will be just gone, the small island states in the Pacific. And other countries will just lose important coastal areas, you know, like in Florida, obviously, but the Florida Keys, you know, they will most likely not be able to protect the Florida Keys, but also New York and San Francisco get problems. They don't have to vanish, but they get problems. And the same will be with river floods. With river floods, it's more complicated because they come suddenly. There's no, you know, slowly increasing sea level that you can see, you know, increasing and you can protect against. They're coming suddenly, so if you don't take the signs as serious, and if you don't protect in accordance with the science, then it's really dangerous for the lives of the population.
As we wrap up, many of us are concerned that government-funded climate science is being dismantled and defunded in the United States and in Australia. We need to hear that Europe, China, and other countries can continue the science we need. Could you just briefly tell us, what is the Potsdam Institute and what does it work on?
Well, the Potsdam Institute is working on all parts of the climate problem. We have a physical unit, if you like, and that's including me, but we also have biologists and sociologists, political scientists, economists, and try to capture the essence of it, of all the different angles of climate change. Because as you see already here, climate mitigation is a societal problem. We have to solve this without causing harm to the economy globally. Yeah? We have to switch the entire energy system of the planet to renewable energies, because as long as we emit carbon, the carbon stays in the atmosphere practically forever, and as long as we do this, we increase the temperature of the planet. So there is a societal aspect to it, and we work on this. But there's also a societal aspect to adaptation. You know, the climate impacts generally occur at one place, so you could say that adaptation is a local phenomena. But the moment you include some kind of justice into the equation, it becomes a non-local, it becomes a global question, because the people who suffer most from it, from climate change, are not necessarily the ones that cause the problem. And in the future, we will have to really harvest the entire creativity and innovative power of the planet in order to face this problem in adaptation. And for this, we need a global scheme and global incentive scheme, which is complicated, I guess, and we'll have to make it robust. And these are the problems that we work on in Potsdam.
Professor Anders Levermann is from Potsdam University in Germany and the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. He also works with Columbia University in New York. We've been discussing an important new paper published in the journal Science Advances. The title is Adaptation Required to Preserve Future High-End River Flood Risk at Present Levels. You can find links to all of this in my show blog at ecoshock.org, published every Wednesday. Anders, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
No, it was great. You're very, very informed and very impressed. And thanks a lot, you know, for getting so deep into our study. I mean it. It's really great. And thanks.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. A best of Radio EcoShock replay. Most news reports about climate change warn about the frightening impact on humans. But what will happen to the animals and the plants? How does nature respond to sudden climate shifts? Our guest is Dr. Anthony Barnosky from the University of California, Berkeley. He is a paleoecologist, a longtime field researcher, and a curator of a museum of fossil mammal collections. His book is Heatstroke, Nature in an Age of Global Warming. You talk about how evolution may not be able to keep up with the changes that are coming so quickly. What is happening with evolution as far as climate change goes?
And it turns out those mutation rates are typically pretty slow when you compare them against the pace of the kind of climatic change we're seeing now. So yes, climatic change can put a selection pressure on a species to change and adapt, but really there's a speed limit that evolution can operate, and climate change is exceeding that speed limit. It turns out that really the kinds of species that have a chance of adapting and that will probably do quite well are the kinds of species that have really short generation times and produce many, 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 many individuals with each reproduction event. So what kind of species are those? Well, they're flies, mosquitoes, rats, the kinds of things we typically don't care for as humans, and the kinds of things we do like, you know, the lions and tigers and bears have very long generation times, very small numbers of offspring, so they don't have a chance to catch up evolutionarily.
Does that project as far as species extinction goes? What are scientists predicting the range there might be from climate change?
The basic answer to that is we're committed to some significant amount of climate change, even under the best case scenarios. By the 2050s, right in that ballpark, Earth is going to be hotter than it's been since humans evolved as a species, and that doesn't matter which of the scenarios you use. I think there are going to be some effects on species as far as certainly where species can live on Earth, and I think it will accelerate the rate of extinction of some of these endangered species that we're trying to protect, so that we have to take that into account and maybe change our strategies a bit on how we're trying to protect them.
That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.